Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We're joined by Brett and Alice from the Prosecutors Podcast, and we are so excited to finally talk to you guys. We've been working on it for a while. Welcome to True Crime Cast.
Thank you guys for having us. We're so happy to be here.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you. I just want to point out that I was on time, but Diva Brett was a little bit late.
It's true. It's true. My apologies.
Hey, if you're Brett, you can make people wait for you, I guess.
And I guess fatherhood kind of power. Is acceptable. So yes. we'll give them some grace.
I don't even know where my kids are. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. They're a little bit older than yours. So I think that's okay. I think they're home. We'll see.
The social worker in me has a lot more questions. So we'll just ignore them for now.
As your attorney, I'm going to say, turn off the recording before you discuss that.
Yes, exactly. I love it. See, that's why I need to talk to you guys to keep us out of trouble. In our communications, I said, you know, you guys have a very unique place in podcasting. We talk to investigators all the time. There are all kinds of law enforcement people. There are all kinds of random people like us who have gotten into the storytelling piece of it. Not a lot of attorneys do this. And I mentioned it to Alice and she said, well, maybe they're just smarter than us, was her response off the air. But what made you guys decide to start a podcast in addition to practicing law?
I don't think we thought anybody would listen was the first thing.
It seemed like
the danger was low. But I mean, this was something Alice and I worked together. We were both prosecutors in the same office, and we would talk about true crime cases all the time because, you know, the crime we were working with wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And we would go for coffee and we'd talk about these cases. And finally, I was like, you know what? We should do a podcast. And Alice said, no way.
No way. No way, Jose, because my answer off the air is still the right one. Lawyers don't do podcasts because they're smarter. They know. They're incredibly risk averse. And whenever you talk, as we tell our witnesses, the more you talk, the more trouble you get into. And podcasting is just talking. But Brett wore me down. I really did say no for like a year. I told him no for a year.
I think there are a lot of people glad they're happy you finally said yes. We were talking to Alice. A lot of the stories you guys tell from your time working together was in D.C., but neither of you live in D.C. now, but you still live close together. Did she make you move down there with her, Brett, to Alabama just to show her the ropes? What was that like?
You know, it was completely random, which is kind of crazy. We met in D.C., and we both want to get out of D.C. because if you live in D.C., you know, D.C. is a great town when you're, I don't know, 15 years younger than I am.
Yep.
And when we did, we both had these opportunities in Alabama and we ended up working in, like I said, we shared a wall so we could just, you know, if we needed to see each other, we could bang on the wall.
That is so wild. Such a weird, weird coincidence.
It was meant to be.
Yeah.
It was.
So now you guys are, you're both still practicing attorneys. Is that right?
We are.
Yeah.
Stupid to because we definitely both still litigate full time, which anyone who litigates knows that you're beholden to deadlines by the court, you know, things that are out of your control, meaning it's around the clock kind of job. But we do it because we love it. We're nerds. We really do actually love the law. And then we don't get enough of it. So after our kids go to bed and we've worked all day, we like to log on and podcast about the law some more.
I love it. And I'm glad you do.
You guys put out a lot of content. So in addition to practicing law all day, I can't imagine the amount of time that you put into this. At some point, in your journey, have you been like, all right, it's enough? Because you have the Prosecutors Podcast, you have your legal briefs. I mean, are we getting a third Prosecutors brand coming along soon?
I think everyone has limits, and our limit may have been 2 podcasts ago.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you're right. It does take a lot of time, but I think we've kind of got, you know, we're in like a rhythm now. We know how to how to balance it and how to schedule it and do the research when we need to. We have help now, yep. which is nice. But a third one would definitely kill us. Yeah. Two almost kills us.
I would say this would not be possible at all for a couple things. Brett and I are friends. Like, we really are friends. This is not something we put on. These are not characters we put on for the podcast. And so we have an unscripted show. It really is discussion based. And we don't really discuss these cases with each other ahead of time. And so you're catching us as if we are grabbing coffee at the office, talking about these cases. And, you know, we literally press record. And if a show is an hour long, we record for like an hour and 3 minutes. You know, there's no editing, snipping things together. We leave it all in there because we want people to see how the sausage is made, sure. how lawyers think about these cases, because we want to pull back that curtain. Oftentimes on TV, you just see the conclusion, the sentence, the conviction, the closing argument. But so much goes into, you know, an entire case beyond the headline, beyond the clickbait. And we think that everyone gets to know their judicial system better when they get to see how we think through it and arrive at it. And so if we weren't able to record that way, I think a podcast would be a lot harder, because then you'd have to perfectly script what you say. You have to clip and edit, you know, the perfect sound bites. Instead, you just get Alice and Brett totally unfiltered, which, good or bad, is what you get.
Yeah, I think you can tell you guys are good friends, and that's part of the charisma of the show. But also, just what you said is a great segue into where I wanted to go with this conversation. Of most podcasts, ours and others, you get you talk about the case, you talk about whatever the crime was, you talk about the investigation, the arrest, and then we jump to the trial, and then were they found guilty or not. You all live kind of in between the pieces of that that we don't get to see and don't even really know what it looks like. So that's what I want to know, just as a fan of true crime. When do prosecutors get involved? When does that hit your desk if an arrest is going to be made or an investigation's happening? What's that like?
You know, it really is going to depend. Different prosecutors, different offices, different jurisdictions are different. I would say, even in our office, Alice and I had cases where we were in it from the very beginning. We're basically, I'll just give you an example of how one of our cases went. You have a whistleblower who just walks into a police department and says, hey, there's this whole fraudulent scheme going on. People are stealing all this money. And that gets the case started. And you're there from the very beginning, and you're, you know, helping interview witnesses and putting things together and pulling documents and looking at them and all that other sort of stuff. And those are the best cases when you're in it from the very beginning. And then other cases, an officer or an agent walks into your office, drops a file folder on your desk, and basically everything's there. And they're like, hey, we got a case. We got the goods on this guy. We're ready to go. And so it really can depend based on the crime and just based on the circumstances in a particular office.
Sometimes at work, when I, like, a case comes to my desk and depends on who gives it to me, I'm either like, all right, this is going to be up and shut, we're good to go. Or an individual will give it to me and I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to really take a look at this one. Similar cases with you guys, like if somebody, you know, do you ever get into a case and say, oh boy, this is not going to be a good one?
All the time. I mean, it really is. The simple cases, quote unquote, are the open and shut ones where, you know, maybe very few elements. It's pretty clear. Maybe there was a traffic stop and someone was found with a pound of meth on their body and they said, don't touch my meth. You know, like, pretty clear case. There's not much to go on there, but I would agree with you. That the majority of cases, because we're trained in a different way than law enforcement, and that's why we work together, will open and say, you know what? They didn't talk to this witness. This is really important. We need to run down who owns this car and who this tag goes back to and what this person says, because it links to their bank account. And, you know, sometimes our law enforcement officer, always, they are wonderful to work with. Sometimes they do roll their eyes because they're like, lawyers, they take the fun out of everything. But that's our job, right? Our job is to make sure that all of those leads are investigated, so that when we go ready to charge a case, we have essentially finished the investigation. We don't want to leave any kind of hanging questions out there before we charge, because it's a very important decision, especially as the prosecutor, to hold that power in your hands.
And I think some people are under the misimpression that law enforcement works for the prosecutor. And it's not really true. It's more like sort of a hand in glove type situation where, you know, in some ways it almost feels like we work for them or they're our client, right? And you have to have this sort of collaborative relationship. A prosecutor who will not last very long is one who thinks they can tell the police to do whatever they want them to do without giving them a reason. As Alice said, the police want to get it right. And if you tell them, hey, we got this hole in our case, I'm concerned, you know, there's some reasonable doubt here, or a defense attorney may be able to spin this, and if we do these investigative steps, we can close that hole, we can get the evidence we need. And even if they're like, well, I don't know, they'll usually, especially if they respect you, they'll say, okay, let's go do that. And they'll go out and do it, and working together in that collaborative fashion. And they're often coming to us and saying, hey, can we do X, Y, and Z? Do we need a warrant for this? Should I get a subpoena? All those sorts of things. So it's very, if it works the way it's supposed to, it's two groups working together very closely. And sometimes you see a real problem when you have prosecutors and the police who almost seem like they're adverse to each other. They're just fighting all the time. When you have that, that is a bad situation to be in.
If you kind of zoom out a little bit, you all ultimately have the same goal. You want to get the bad guys to face justice, right? So why would there be a contentious relationship? If I'm an officer and I want him to go to jail because he murdered somebody, and you want to make sure he does too, but it's done in a way that is going to end with the same result, why would we not want to work well together?
It's not that you don't want to work well together. It's that prosecutors and law enforcement always have limited resources, right? I mean, whenever you see on the news, people are like, the police failed to do X, Y, and Z. Truly, any investigation is limitless. Same with any prosecution. You essentially have to have the wisdom and know when to have the judgment call to say, this is enough for our case, because you could investigate a case forever. You could, you know, do your legal research and factual development forever as a prosecutor. And so there could be at odds, because when you do spend more time on one case, you are actively taking away resources from another case. So it's not working against each other, but rather recognizing the balance of priorities among sometimes thousands of cases that may need your attention and resources.
And, you know, there's one factor that can come into it is oftentimes the police are working under a different burden. They think of their burden oftentimes as probable cause. Mm-hmm. You know, they need probable cause to get a warrant. They need probable cause to make an arrest. They need probable cause to go to the grand jury. And oftentimes the prosecutor is thinking the next step down the road. Yes, we need probable cause to do all those things. I need beyond a reasonable doubt to convict. And so you can have a situation where, you know, imagine your murderer situation, where you have someone who's dangerous. How dangerous are they? They've killed somebody and they're on the street. And you have an officer who's like, we have to get this person off the street. We've got enough evidence to do it. Let's move now. And you have a prosecutor who's like, well, hold on now. You know, I want to make sure we get the ballistics lined up and get that thing back. And they're like, man, why aren't you ready to go? And that can be, I mean, it's a conflict and it's an important one. And it's not necessarily that one side is right and the other one isn't, or one side is being unreasonable and the other one isn't. It's just a different way of viewing it. And I'll tell you, I've had a case one time where it was a search warrant issue and we had a crime and we didn't know who did it. And we had a suspect and it was a strong suspect. And the officers, they believed we've got probable cause to go in and search this person's house. And I was like, I don't know, guys, I think we need one more thing. And we had some contentious meetings about that. And it turned out eventually we realized it wasn't that guy. And I was really glad, and they were really glad, that we had slowed things down. We didn't move too fast and we didn't end up, you know, busting down somebody's door and searching their house. It turned out they didn't even do it. So having those sort of back and forth and being willing to lay out exactly what you think and be honest with each other and be contentious sometimes, that's important, both to find the right guy and to protect the rights of the citizens, which is something you ultimately want to do.
And is that tension and that relationship going all the way up to trial? Like at some point, is there a handoff to the prosecutor? Is law enforcement right there with you the whole time?
I mean, once you indict, a lot of it is in our hands in terms of the burdens of the court. But no, it is hand in hand with law enforcement the entire way because you need witnesses. And you're also, leads come up as people are arrested, as they either come in or don't come in. They want to talk to the police. They want to cooperate. They're doing jailhouse confessions. You know, things are happening that require additional investigation. And so law enforcement, it is their case from beginning to end. I mean, we may come in at different steps of the case before a case is indicted, but the investigator really is there from usually, you know, lead all the way to conclusion. And they view it that way as well. They take it very seriously. And ultimately, if you go to trial, that investigator is going to be on the stand. They're probably going to be your key witness as well. And everything that they've done in this case is relevant, and they will have to testify to it. And they are the ones whispering in our ear as someone's testifying, and like, oh, no. Joe said this. Remember, let me pull up the report to show you how you can impeach him with this information. So they are absolutely our partners, even once the case is in court.
I mentioned on our show one time that I've lived in this county for like almost 20 years and I've never been called for jury duty. And then the next week I got called. So I'm sitting in this room with like 200 people. And I think I'm like the only one out of 200 that's like, please pick me, please pick me, please pick me. Because I thought, how cool would that be? But then they were also selecting for grand jury. And when the judge described that, I was like, oh, I want that. Can you, for our listeners, kind of like talk, educate us on like, what is the grand jury's job? Because we all know what the jury is for a regular trial. What's the grand jury's role in how cases get through the court system?
Sure. And so the grand jury is a really important part of it, because the grand jury in a lot of ways is kind of a bulwark of the citizens against government overreach. And sometimes people will say, you know, grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. And there is, that is true to a certain extent because the standard is lower. So a petite jury, a trial jury, they have to find someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. A grand jury is looking at whether or not there's probable cause to believe someone committed a crime such that you would return an indictment. And this is a right you have constitutionally. If it's a federal case, it's actually interesting. You don't necessarily have a right to grand jury in a state prosecution, but a lot of states have them anyway. And they're the first group of citizens who hear a case. So the prosecutor shows up. It's just him. Defense attorney's not there. Potential defendant's not there because he's not a defendant yet. And he shows up, or she shows up, and says, hey, 18 people, because usually there's 18 of them, not 12. We have this case, and we think this is the statute that was violated. And we're going to call a couple witnesses, and we're going to put on some evidence to show you that there's probable cause to think the statute was violated and that it was this person who did it. And at the conclusion of that, the grand jury decides whether or not to issue that indictment. And if they don't, then the case can't move forward. The prosecutor can't just say, well, I disagree with you guys. What do y'all know? We're taking this to trial. No, that is, until you get past that stage, you can't continue forward. So grand jury, you know, whereas a trial jury hears one case, a grand jury might hear hundreds of cases, and they might return any number of what we call no bills, which is when they say to the prosecutor, you don't have it yet. You don't have it yet. If you're ever going to have it, you need to go back out and do more work. You need to do more investigation before we turn this citizen over to the judicial system. You need to get your house in order. So I agree with you. I think it would be a lot of fun to be on a grand jury,
especially in a small community like we live in. I was like, oh man, this will be so much tea. Like I want to sit through this so bad.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like my neighbor rolled up in an ankle monitor and I'm like, what's the story here?
Yeah. No, not me. I am his neighbor. No. I was not the one in the ankle monitor.
It's just a really interesting system, and it's a great system. And I was going to ask you like, if it was a constitutional right for there to be grand jury, and you already answered that question. Have you guys ever had to, I'm sitting in this room of 200 people and I'm like, if I'm ever on trial, like there's some people in here I would not want to be like, this is not a jury of my peers. So to say, like, there's some funny people in this room. Like, how do you weed people out? Like, what are you looking for as a, you know, if you're prosecuting the case, how do you get the jury to be what you want it to be?
Great question. Jury selection is an art, not a science. And we always say, you're not picking your jury. you're picking who you don't want on your jury because of precisely what you say. It's going to depend on the type of case. It's going to depend whether it's a criminal case, civil case, whether you're the prosecutor, whether you're the defendant, who you like. You know, there's, and these are all guesses, right? You have very little information for a very large population of people. In your case, if it's 200 people, that veneer is not that large, right? So you have 200 people that you're trying to assess in a split second. And you may get a questionnaire. They are not forced to fill out this questionnaire. A lot of people do. A lot of people don't. I've never had an entire veneer where I had every person fill out a questionnaire. It's always some percent. It's like 80%, right? Yeah. I think that's about right of people who turn in their homework. And these questionnaires say a lot of things. You know, every jurisdiction can set what these questionnaires say. But they're trying to get at certain potential leanings or biases that someone may have. So it'll have things like demographics, like, you know, if you have a job, what type of education you have, where you live, that may matter because within a jurisdiction, there could be urban, suburban, rural, and that may come with it different ways of viewing the community. But then there are some kind of questions that you may not necessarily expect that are not purely demographic. You know, our jurisdiction's questionnaire will have things like, what podcasts do you listen to? What newspapers or publications do you regularly read? What bumper stickers do you have, if any, on your car?
Really?
You know, things like that. Do you drive an electric or a gas vehicle? I mean, it's, truly, people who've never filled out these questions are like, what? What is this? And the idea is, there's no way we could possibly know what all 200 of you think. And one person who says they listen to true crime could be so pro-police, and another person who listens to the exact same, you know, true crime podcast could be like, defund the police. So there's only so much you know based on these questionnaires, but you have these kind of backgrounds, which give you some amount of information. And then there's something called voir dire. Voir dire is questioning of the jury. Each jurisdiction does it differently. Some jurisdiction, the judge does all the questioning. I personally prefer, because I have some more control over it, in our jurisdiction, the lawyers often can question them. And what you're trying to do is ask about how they feel about certain things. If you have, for example, a child sex abuse case, you want to know if people have ever experienced that in their lives and what they think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you have someone who's like, anyone who does that, death penalty. If you're the defendant, that is not someone you want on your jury. And so instead of picking who your jury is, you're thinking, I don't want that person on my jury because he's definitely going to be against my client. And so it really is snap judgments. And that's the thing. You know, we've heard of people hiring jury consultants. I've actually never used one, but we've picked enough juries to know that it's impossible to get it perfectly right. And you also don't have all the time in the world. The judge is looking to you and saying, which one do you want to cut? Which one do you want to cut? Which one do you want to cut? And you don't have time to say, let me take 10 minutes and kind of think about this, pray about this, Facebook them, LinkedIn them. There's none of that. You're truly going by feel and experience. And you're making snap judgments about what something might think about someone. So very broad strokes for people. You know, certain jobs, people are always joking, they always get cut from the jury. Like lawyers always get cut because we overthink things.
I was wondering if I would get cut because I'm a social worker and I host a true crime podcast.
Yeah, what about that? I am currently on call for a federal district court. I was supposed to report yesterday and it got canceled. If I go up there and like I've produced 500 episodes of true crime in the last decade, is that gonna impact it at all, or will they roll their eyes?
Oh, they won't roll their eyes at all. I would not say you get an automatic out.
Yeah.
But
I don't want out. Yeah.
Yeah. I would. Yeah. I could imagine both sides thinking, oh, no, they've seen too much of this. Right. They know how jury manipulation goes, or X, Y, and Z, you know, wrongful convictions. They know too much, basically, or they'll overthink it or think this is just entertainment. You can imagine all the things.
Sure.
Things they think.
Do you have a right?
Prosecutor once who said he always cuts teachers, preachers, and engineers. So it's like you just different people have sort of different views about what they don't want.
Interesting. I wonder why the engineer.
Because they
aren't swayed by emotion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And remember, jury is storytelling.
Yeah.
And the other problem with them is life's messy and they're used to everything being perfect and scientific and setting up. And it's like, that's not how it is. So. Yeah.
And
then teachers and preachers are too forgiving.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, get that.
Let's pretend like I'm a prosecutor, Jamie's a defendant. can I object? Like if he cuts someone, do I say, no, I like this guy, I want him here? Or is it just,
nope,
you're out because he says you're out?
So you get certain number of cuts and you get some for cause. Like this person has said, I don't think anyone should go to jail. You could cut them for cause. There are also peremptory strikes, which you can cut someone for any reason. Case law has since developed where you like can't cut someone purely because, sure, of their race, for example. Mm-hmm. But you kind of have this set of, and once you're out of those cuts, you're done. And the other side doesn't get to challenge them. That's why it's a game of picking who you don't want on your jury, because you're looking down the list and it's numerical, right? So number 200, you probably won't ever get there. So you probably don't have to save your strikes for number 200. But if someone you are like, that person's going to be against my client, and they're like number 5 out of 200, you want to use your strike on them, especially, you know, no matter what, to get them out. And then you have to just kind of ration it, because what if you run out and then like you're out of cuts and that, you know, whatever 21st person is just that teacher, preacher, and engineer. You're stuck with them.
Yeah. Jeez. I won't say any, there's so many things I want to say, probably not appropriate, but yeah, there were like, there was a row in front of me. There might've been like 5 brain cells between 3 people. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my God, please. Like I've even talked to Jamie, like, do we need professional jurors? Because I mean, good Lord, some of us are just stupid.
Yes. Yeah, some of us in this room, yeah. I think I worry about that. You mentioned consultants. I'm a big fan of the movie Runaway Jury. I just assumed that was crap. Do consultants really exist?
Oh, they definitely exist. And they're usually expensive.
Sure.
Whether, you know, I think it very much depends on the jurisdiction. If it's like a civil case for car accidents and this person's seen like 300 of them, maybe they do know the exact type of person who's going to give you that $200,000 judgment. And, you know, we're not talking about the death penalty or something.
Yeah.
I think they're better at telling you which arguments are going to work and which arguments tend to work. Or like getting, you know, a lot of times people with a lot of money in these big civil cases, they'll run the trial through in front of a few fake juries, just juries just taken from normal people. They'll do their arguments. They'll interview the jurors, hear what worked, hear what didn't. It's like focus grouping.
Wow.
It's like a politician.
My clients do that all the time. Like there's like a little buzzer, like back in the game show days, where as an argument is being told by an attorney, they're pressing like, I believe it, I don't believe it. And so you see like a graph, like as if you're on a game show in real time.
That's awesome.
And it takes a lot of money to do something like that.
Well, if anybody ever wants to pay us to do it, I think John and I would be interested.
I would get paid to push buttons all day. Yeah. Sign me
up. That's pretty much what I do.
I've been in court because of my profession, but Jamie, I don't know, other than your adoption, how much time you spent in court. He's wrote a question down, like, what's your relationship with like if you're a prosecutor, what's the relationship with a defense attorney? Is it always contentious? Do you have beers after the trial? Like what's it like?
Especially when you're a prosecutor and there's a defense bar, you're against the same people a lot, right? And you have an interest, both of you, not to be jerks to each other, because ultimately you're supposed to be both in pursuit of justice. Obviously, the defense attorney has a client who they have to serve, but ultimately you want a good working relationship, because that's going to be better overall for justice, for the taxpayers' dollars. And usually for a criminal defendant, if they need to plead guilty, it's better to have that attorney who tries to work out the best deal for them and convince them it's better than going to trial, getting smashed with the evidence, wasting weeks and victims and, you know, all the emotional effort in order to get even a higher sentence. So, you know, we always do our best to have a civil relationship with the defense bar. Things obviously get heated within any particular case, but as professionals, you know, leave it in the courtroom. And we don't often get beers with them only because of professional ethics rules. Mm-hmm. We are almost always in a case against them and we don't want any appearance of bias for their client, because you can imagine if you saw your attorney having drinks with your prosecutor, that might not make you feel good as a criminal defendant. So, but certainly there are ones that I've grown to respect very much. And when they make an argument, I really listen, because I'm like, you know what? you don't give me BS. I know I can trust you, and vice versa. I hope they feel that way about me, that I'm not just bringing, you know, the most obscene charges I possibly can because some grand jury allowed me to bring it.
I have seen things get so heated in court, and then clients leave, we're out in the hallway, and we're like, nothing ever happened. And I'm like, guys, you guys just wanted to freaking kill each other a minute ago. What's happened? But yeah, and it is a respect for each other. But at the same time, you both want to nail home a point, or you feel like, you know, every case is different, but it's just interesting.
And a lot of times there's a lot of gray area in these cases. I mean, the law is often not clear. That's why we have lawyers, and we, you know, pay some of them, not the government ones, a lot of money to do that. And so you will have strident, intense arguments, but it should never get personal. And frankly, when it does, and you see that more and more these days, I feel like, unfortunately, especially the more the trials are publicized, mm-hmm. and the video camera and playing for the cameras and everything, that's not good for anybody. It's not good for the taxpayers. It's not good for the clients. Overall, if you have prosecutors and defense attorneys who respect each other, they don't have to like each other, respect each other, trust each other, know that they can trust each other, that's the way you're going to get the most justice. And I think Alice is right. That is going to work out better for even defendants over the long term.
You've been doing some awesome podcasts, and I'm curious, you know, obviously your podcasts are influenced by your careers as attorneys. How has your attorney profession been impacted by your podcast? Like, is there any, have you looked at laws or cases differently because of the cases that you've covered? Does that impact your practice at all?
You know, we've talked about this on the podcast before. While we don't change who we are, our friendship, our relationship, our you know, professional lives when we go on the podcast, one thing we get to do on the podcast that we don't get to do in our professional lives is to allow ourselves to feel the full weight of the tragedies, mm-hmm. To really put ourselves in the shoes of the victims, the defendants, the family members, the prosecutors, the law enforcement officers, anyone who's kind of affected by it, because we have to have that kind of emotional divide when we are prosecuting a case. It's the best thing for the victims. It's the best thing for the case for us not to get too emotionally invested. And so while we don't lose sight of the victim, we don't lose sight of the human element, it is not something we're able to dwell in our professional lives. But it is something that is so important. The very humanity of these cases is, I think, why so many people are drawn to true crime. And the podcast allows us to kind of explore more freely that aspect of a case that we have to cabin for professional purposes during our workday. And for me, that's been very cathartic. It's been very helpful to be able to feel the full weight of what we do on a daily basis without allowing it to break me, because it's not my actual case. We don't ever cover cases that are within our jurisdiction or that we prosecute for ethical reasons. And so I'm able to feel the full weight of a case where I don't actually have responsibility within it. And that's a real privilege to get to do, because I'm working through very complex emotions and thoughts that I can then import into my professional life without making my real cases on my docket suffer.
There have been so many cases where we've talked about children getting hurt. And because, like I say, I'm able to compartmentalize, and like, I can talk about it as if I'm at work, where, like you said, I don't let that become emotional to me, because if I did, I'd be a freaking mess all day. But it's interesting to see Jamie, who does not live in that world every day, when we're talking about cases like this, and he's like on his phone, uncomfortable. And I'm just like, what's up, dude? So early on, I was like, okay, we're covering something awful here, Jamie. I need you to. Yeah. It's interesting how, because I live in it every day, it's different, you know? I get that.
And I'm sure you guys like have handled a variety of different types of cases. What does that range look like? And are there any of those cases where, or types of crimes where you're like, oh, I can't with this. This kills me. Or are there others that you're like, ooh, good, I love looking at this type of law?
You know, I mean, I think Alice and I in our professional career have covered the gamut of cases, yeah, from you know, white collar fraud cases to violent crimes with real victims and just real tragedies. And I always prefer the white collar ones because it's a lot less emotional.
I bet,
it's like Alice was saying, you know, there's something about when you feel like there's a real person out there who has been victimized, and getting justice for that person is on you. And the prosecutors who handle those cases day in and day out. And we have, you tend to have prosecutors who specialize in things like child sexual abuse and who are in that because they care so much about the victims, and they're willing to endure a lot of trauma, a lot of vicarious trauma because of the things they see and the things they hear, because it is so important to them to be a voice for those victims. And we see that in our jobs. And I think, as Alice was saying, one great thing about the podcast, and I think this is true for true crime in general, the sort of mystery of why is true crime so popular? I think one of the reasons is because we all have in our lives these things that we need to work out, you know, and true crime is a great way to do it. It's a great way to understand why there is so much evil in the world, but also to see that there's good working against it and attempting to bring justice to people and uncover truths. And so I think you see there's like a hand in hand to that, that we've seen both in our job and in our podcast and through the people who listen to our podcast and will send us emails, some of the most gratifying emails we have. And when people send us emails and they say, hey, I'd been struggling with something and I heard your latest episode and it really helped me, that those are the ones that mean the most to me.
Sure. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. And we appreciate the work you all do. And like I said, this is a part of the process that I think most of us are blind to, and you guys live in it every day. So we're thankful that you do that work so that we don't have to, but also thankful that you're willing to kind of share that with us and our listeners.
Is it weird that I have a Mr. Rogers quote in my head right now?
But which one it is, I guess.
When you said that, it made me think of like old school Mr. Rogers. He said that when something bad happens, look for the people who are helping, because you can take something awful and, you know, you're doing something good. So appreciate it.
And I love Mr. Rogers. So
yeah, I didn't think I would quote Mr. Rogers tonight, but it worked out. That's
the thing. This podcasting road takes you places you would never know. So it took me to Crime Con. I got to meet you guys down in Nashville. Hopefully we'll get to meet up again sometime in person. John will maybe accompany me then and not leave me hanging out to dry.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
I sent you a five. Did
he come to Denver?
Yeah, we're excited about the possibility of that, and hope to, of course, connect with you guys when we do. But until then, where can our listeners find you?
You can find the prosecutors and the prosecutors' legal briefs wherever you listen to podcasts. And we love it. So the prosecutors is kind of your typical storytelling. We cover cases in single episodes or multi-part episodes. And we sometimes cover trials that are going on in real time. And then legal briefs, we try to be able to kind of react more to true crime news. So there's a filing that drops in a case and, you know, you get a lot of clickbait. We try to just demystify that and explain legal concepts to people because, like you guys said, we want the jury of your peers to be more educated. We want everyone to be part of you know, what the Constitution envisioned. Everyone should have a role in their judicial system. And we're hoping that through entertainment, they're also able to learn a little bit more about the system in which they live, because at some point in our lives, we are going to be, you know, faced with it, whether because you're in court yourself, you're on the jury, or you have to call upon the justice system to seek justice for you or a loved one. And the more you know, the better. So that's our hope through our podcasts.
That was an amazing elevator pitch. I'm sold.
I wanted to stand up and like.
John and I are really both listeners. We pay attention to your shows quite a bit. So we appreciate that. And more than anything, we appreciate your time here today. And we hope to do it again soon.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having us.
Thank you. You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.